the last word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Joining us through the week trending, Roe McDermott, a journalist, Irish Times columnist, Dave Hanratty, podcast producer for The Independent and host of the No Encores podcast. I do want to talk about the rows of the week for some light relief, perhaps, from all the stuff that's going on. But there is a serious issue that I want to talk about first. This international survey, which did a focus on Ireland and knowledge of the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. So, Ro, tell us about this and particularly the findings among young Irish adults.
Yeah, so a survey found that almost 1 in 10 Irish people aged between 18 and 29 believe the Holocaust is a myth, while nearly 20% believe its scale has been exaggerated. And half of Irish adults do not know that 6 million Jews were murdered. But despite this, over 90% support Holocaust education in school. So I think there's a few things happening here, and all of it is kind of terrifying. There's general ignorance about the amount of Jewish people who were killed during the Holocaust and a lack of awareness around it. I think that comes from a few things. I think the way history is taught in secondary school in particular, it can be kind of a one and done lesson. Like, history isn't incorporated through, like, this is a historical understanding. Here is how today's events are influenced by history. And I think that needs to be updated. So there could be kids who just miss a week in school for whatever reason, and then because of that, education isn't continuing either in their education or in kind of long form media where things are contextualized and journalists and writers have room to go into historical documents. So that's the ignorance aspect. But what is really scary is this divide of people saying this idea of the myth and this idea of things have been exaggerated, because that isn't ignorance, that is based in conspiracy and denial. And that's really scary, because that's this idea of historical illiteracy and conspiracy theories in kind of the algorithm age, because so many young people are getting their information from TikToks, from YouTubers. And unfortunately, there's so many conspiracy theorists out there. There's so much misinformation, disinformation, and there's a lack of trust in kind of very authoritative news sources and trustworthy news sources. And so people are going down these rabbit holes. And as we know, I think there's a lot of very disaffected, disenfranchised youth out there who are searching for meaning and are finding it in really nefarious sources that are telling them, welcome into our little club and we know the real truth, and then are spreading absolute lies and denial.
There's an awful lot of fake news going up on social media in particular, isn't there?
Yeah.
And fake history, shall we say.
That's the thing, because I think we think about misinformation and disinformation in the age we live in, and we apply it to current events and things that are happening right in front of us right now and so on. But actually, to take an event like the Holocaust and to go back all those decades and to apply the modern day tactics of misinformation and disinformation to that is, first of all, baffling and, you know, odd behavior. I don't know why you would want that to be your raison d'etre, but reality is it's happening. And this survey is reflective of similar surveys in the US and in Europe. This is an ongoing problem. I've encountered this firsthand with some young people who I've spoken to, and I've been dismayed and very depressed by the fact that they will come out and they will speak factually about a thing that they are completely incorrect about and haven't done the correct research on. And as Ro correctly says, there are, you know, whether it's manosphere-centric YouTube channels and podcasts or bots on the internet or people who just have a horrible agenda, there are people out there who are weaponizing this. Whether they're monetizing it is another question, but they are in fact infecting young minds, in my opinion. And, like, you know, I think back to my days in school and this was taught. And I will say, like, one good thing in the survey was that 92% of Irish adults wanted to be taught in schools, largely so that it doesn't happen again. And it's especially galling in today's world when we see similar things happening in the world and wonder, well, how could you possibly deny this? And why, like, if your gut reaction is to try and discredit the Holocaust, what are you trying to accomplish?
But I think we really have to be, and I think parents, unfortunately, have to be so aware of the influence of people outside of Ireland, because we can say, we can look at the States, for example, where neo-Nazism is on the right, which is just Nazism. And there's a video out of Nick Fuentes singing along to a Kanye West song and saying Heil Hitler in a nightclub. And this idea of right-wing YouTubers and young influencers embracing kind of Holocaust denialism and these fascist Nazi ideals. But the thing is that the internet is global now. And so young Irish boys in particular and young people are being exposed to these ideas that we could think of as, oh yeah, they're not impacting Ireland, but the YouTube and the internet has made everything globalized, and so these ideas are indeed crossing the waters and reaching us.
You've done a lot of work for us over the years as a movie reviewer, and maybe this is a really simplistic approach, but if people aren't reading books about the Holocaust, you know, are movies the way, and I'm thinking of The Zone of Interest was one of the most moving movies I've seen in recent years. If you go back further, the likes of Schindler's List, that if you actually are exposed to movies like that, that you become more interested in finding out the reality of a topic like that.
Completely. And I think there's two things in that. One is this kind of comfort we have with generational knowledge of the idea of oh yes, we've all seen Schindler's List and we're all aware of the Holocaust, and actually being very consciously saying we need to still transmit this information and this knowledge and this sense of empathy and awareness to the next generation and not rely on kind of an old outdated media. But I also think that idea of movies and books and TV shows being these points of education for so many young people. However, we no longer have a monoculture. Like, I teach 19 and 20 year olds and I'll walk in and say, has anyone been watching this show or has anyone seen this movie? And I can no longer rely on everybody having done that because everybody is watching different things. And so we really need to get a lot of media coverage.
And of course, the problem at times is with movies and rows break out as to whether it's an accurate interpretation of what actually happened, as to whether it's historically factual or not.
100%. Yeah. The Zone of Interest is an excellent example for a number of reasons. The fact is, it's an absolutely brilliant film, and it's so good, and it's harrowing, and it's tough, and it should be. It's about the Holocaust. But that film is PG, and thus, show it in schools. I mean, I know there was a massive push when the television show Adolescence came out to show that in schools about consent and how boys should talk to girls and so on, and I would agree with that. It's an excellent show. But The Zone of Interest should be just mandatory for people to see and watch. It should be available, you know, in libraries and so on and so forth. It's an incredibly powerful work that speaks to, again, decades of suffering and the fact that the society still has problems even acknowledging and actually leaning into what really happened is very, very questionable. But again, like I said, Ro and I were having this conversation outside, and we were like, you don't want to dismiss somebody outright at a young age and say you're wrong, you know, like, and attack them for it. You want to try and bring them into a conversation.
You don't want to isolate them and send them further down a rabbit hole. But I also think we so need to invest more in long form journalism, and we need to have writers and educated people giving space to these issues, because I think young people, if they're reading daily news but we don't have a space where journalists can go in and go, here's the historical context for this, it's almost like young people aren't being given primers to these things when they need it. There's an assumed knowledge that obviously isn't there, and we really need to invest in that.
Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about one of the spats of the last couple of weeks. And you know, you're talking about neo-Nazis. Elon Musk was the man who throwing his arm out and what suspiciously looked like a Nazi salute. Elon Musk is a man who has made many comments over the last year, which for somebody who was born in South Africa during the apartheid regime, are very, very seriously racistly tinged, shall we say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there were a lot of people, maybe Dave, I'll start with you in this one, who have never particularly liked Michael O'Leary of Ryanair, but suddenly found themselves totally on his side in the row that he was having with Elon Musk.
Yeah, is this like the classic example of the enemy of my enemy is my friend? And even to bring it back to films again, like when that film Alien versus Predator, not a classic, came out in 2004, the tagline was, whoever wins, we lose. And that's kind of how I feel about this particular feud.
Now, hang on, I will say there's a lot of people who love Michael O'Leary.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of people will be texting in supporting him, that he's great. They always love his approach to dealing with politicians and the stunts that he actually pulls. So let's not try. And also, an awful lot of people will say that he has provided good value prices for flying that wouldn't be available if it hadn't been for Ryanair. So let's say all that in case people feel there's bias going on.
A lot of people love Elon Musk. A lot of people love Donald Trump. You know, you're entitled to your opinion. Absolutely.
You're not equating them, are you?
No, but we're talking about this. This is a triumvirate thing, because the whole point is that Michael O'Leary went on the attack about Donald Trump and Elon Musk, and Elon Musk fired back and said, you know, I'm going to buy Ryanair and put you out of business or whatever, like, you know, and then it became this big Twitter spat. And, you know, we thought the Brooklyn Beckham thing was the big story of the week in terms of that. But
we'll
get there. Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that stood out to me the most in all this was kind of a sidebar thing where I saw, you know, American users of Twitter aghast at the Ryanair Twitter account. They couldn't believe that it would make these big statements, and it's like, oh, well, you're just not familiar with its quote-unquote cheeky way of going about business and how it's become very, very famous for doing that. Even actually cited on American chat shows on occasion, like Jimmy Fallon being like, can you believe this? But yeah, what is the end game here? Not much of one, I would say. I don't think Elon Musk is going to buy Ryanair.
No, he can't anyway. It's just actually under the rules of ownership of European airlines, it isn't possible for him to do so.
And if he did buy it, if those rules were changed, perhaps, you know, would it be as low fares and cost friendly as it was before? I don't know. I mean, but also, as Michael Leary has pointed out, all publicity is good publicity. He's claiming that actually this has led to a spike in business, and it's keep it coming, basically.
Yeah, he went and did one of his, well, he does a seat sale every January today. So he rebranded it. I think Michael O'Leary was delighted. I think, suspect he was getting bored with running the same stunts year after year, that he was running out of things to talk about. And suddenly he had Elon Musk, of all people, to be able to target.
And again, I wouldn't usually be a fan of Michael O'Leary, but this week I just thought, I said, okay, in this fight, I'm definitely on your side. And I thought he understands outrage and he understands a sense of mischief more than anyone. Like, he is a genius at it, and it's a genius within capitalism, so I'm not a fan. But this is kind of capitalism performance art. Like, saying this is an idiot sale and having pictures of both himself and Elon, like, that's genius. Do you know what I mean? And he's very set. He did a press conference and he was self-deprecating while also mocking Elon Musk, which means it's kind of skewing the usual Trump versus Elon. We're both self-aggrandizing, putting the other down. So he kind of deflates their power a little bit. But I also think he's in a really interesting position because he understands outrage more than most media strategists, but he's also insulated. Like, he isn't going to suffer a huge amount from this. There's no US roots on this. There's EU ownership protection. So this isn't about insults. It's not really about business, because as we said, Elon Musk really isn't in a position to buy Ryanair, but it's attention economics. It's buying into moral outrage and political rage and airline tickets and Michael O'Leary's own reputation, which he's very aware of, and playing into that and getting sales.
I mean, Ryanair is a company that's worth over 30 billion euro. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest airline in Europe. But a piece I read in the FT before all the Financial Times, before all of this broke out, apparently it spends only 4 million euro per annum on advertising and marketing. And that is a fraction of what every other airline, which is even smaller in Europe, does. He doesn't want to spend money. So he comes up with ways to get people talking about him on radio or online. And he has succeeded again.
It works.
All for free.
Here we are doing it. As you say, the attention economy. And again, to go back to that Twitter account, I mean, like, that's a case study. Like, that is taught in creative spaces and advertising agencies. Here's what you can do, and bring people into it, bring people into the conversation, have them do it for you. It's a tale as old as time, but as Roe correctly says, not everyone can do it to the extent that Michael O'Leary has done.
Yeah, but again, and I never thought I'd say Michael O'Leary is coming off as quite courageous, but when you compare him to American CEOs, none of whom call out Elon Musk and none of whom are calling out Trump at the moment, like, him speaking back and joking and taking the mick out of Elon Musk, it looks extreme and it looks like, oh, this is speaking truth to power, when it's Michael O'Leary, which again is not a position I thought I'd put him in. But it's highlighting kind of the cowardice and the power that Elon and Trump have over American CEOs.
I'm going to stop people calling him Elon in first name terms. We have to just call him Musk. But can I tell you that when Donald Trump bought Doombeg, the first person he called in Ireland to discuss it was Michael O'Leary. And O'Leary has told the story of being on the phone for about 50 minutes listening to Trump blather on, Trump asking him whether he should build a ballroom down in Doombeg, which apparently O'Leary said to him yes. Also asking, could he put on extra flights into Shannon to get more people to the golf course, and extra flights into Turnberry in Scotland, where he has well. So I don't think O'Leary was enormously impressed by reports of it, but he did indulge him on the phone for about 50 minutes. And Trump has spoken publicly prior to becoming American president of his admiration for Michael O'Leary as a businessman.
Because he stands up to him. This is the thing. It's the bully in the playground. I guarantee Trump will actually go, oh, fair play to you. You had the balls when others didn't.
But it's also, I think, Trump assuming that anyone who makes money is kind of on the same team as him, which I think is interesting.
He loves winners.
He loves, I mean, again, I hate this framing so deeply. It's ideologically opposed to everything I believe in. But yes, winners. But also this idea of, well, we make money, so we're in the same club. And then Michael O'Leary kind of breaking that and going, well, no, I'm going to take the piss out of you and your mate on Twitter. Again, it's just highlighting how Americans aren't doing it. And I think, you know, even the idea, did anyone see the clip of Denmark's government absolutely losing themselves laughing at Trump. I think we really need to get this out there. We need to bring in this ridicule. And I think the best thing that came out of Kamala Harris and Tim Walz's campaign was the idea of calling Republicans weird. I think we need to bring back like the court gestures of taking the absolute mick out of people in power.
Listener says, Michael O'Leary's spat with Musk was for me was the most welcome and very enjoyable distraction from all of the depressing chaos across the world at the hands of the deranged orange man-child. Well done, Michael O'Leary. Another says, bear in mind that Ryanair is Boeing's biggest customer, which is actually a very fair point as well. Okay, we will return to talk about the other spat of the week, which managed to get an awful lot of attention, the Beckhams, with Roe McDermott and Dave Hanratty after this. Listener says, I'm totally lost. Why does anyone care about the Beckhams or what they do? But I suppose it is a distraction, isn't
it? That's January escapism, 100%. This is what it is. And I will say as well, I work at the Irish Independent, I make podcasts. Our podcast on the Beckhams is the most listened to one we did this month. It is. And we've been covering Trump. We've been covering Irish stories. We've become very, very serious things. And we put that out there and people are obsessed. They just are. And it's also how the other half live. It's a bit of schadenfreude. It does take us away from the Trump events, the world-shaking events and so on and so forth. And we might not want to admit it, but we are, in fact, voyeurs.
Well, completely. But it also taps into so many different things and so many different generations, dynamics. Like, we have people who grew up with Victoria Beckham. We have people who are fans of David Beckham. We have new people who are invested in their children. We have people who are on social media. And it's about a brand. It's about the rebranding of the Beckhams, who did, both of them and collectively, did incredible rebrands. Like, Victoria Beckham was a laughingstock when she started first her solo career, then started trying to go into fashion. Nobody took her seriously. And there's a parallel between her and someone like Kim Kardashian, who fashion houses laughed at and now is kind of a powerhouse within them. Then you have David Beckham. You also have their story of their relationship, of them being such a high-powered couple. They were kind of tabloid fodder, sold their wedding photos to every kind of newspaper.
They got married in Dublin.
Thrones, the photo shoots, then the infidelity scandal, and then the rebranding of like, no, we're such a solid family unit. And now we have younger stars like Brooklyn Beckham and Nicola Peltz. And then these gendered tropes of, oh, is this the spoiled rich girl who's dividing the family? Is this the overbearing mother-in-law? Which people are still like, people are still drawn to these tropes. And it's also this idea of people can be privileged and have drama. And as Irish people, I've done features on this. Irish people have a very complicated relationship with family and with estrangement. And there's a lot of unspoken and unacknowledged estrangement within Irish society. And so I think we're really drawn to this idea of where family ties break down. And then it's playing out publicly, which is kind of fascinating.
So that either we...
anyone who's superior to it, but I'm in.
So some people might have had experience of that, or if they haven't experience of it, they want to know about it for fear that it might happen to them.
Absolutely.
Or also a sense of gratitude that it hasn't happened to them.
Yeah, it's weirdly relatable. Sorry, just to add another gender trope there, like Brooklyn is the prince who was promised and didn't live up to the expectations and the world that we had carved out for him, the world that they commodified him into before he could speak, which is another angle.
So are you taking his side in relation
to this? I genuinely am. With the massive caveat that this man has more money and more freedom than I, you know, could imagine. And you know, at the same time, he's a human being who has no discernible talent. He has had a bunch of failed careers and he clearly has had his life controlled every, you know, stage of it. I mean, would you sign up for that deal? A lot of people listening, maybe they would, maybe I would, but he didn't get the choice to do that himself. And I do think as well, the relatability aspect, especially coming just after Christmas, you go home for Christmas, your families get together, a row happens, everyone's, you know, like on edge, the social pressure. This is the most heightened example of that. And the fact is, it ain't me, it's them. And they're meant to be perfect. I can live vicariously through that and enjoy it, if I'm being honest.
But I think there's a really interesting dynamic of, this is a question of identity, right? It's this idea of a young man saying, my identity has always been tied to the brand of my parents and I'm trying to get away. And people who are critical or people who are siding more with the Beckhams are saying, but actually your identity is now being controlled by your new wife who has wanted to be in the public eye. Your identity is still tied to this kind of power and fame and money. And so the question of, where does actually the young man at the centre, where does he step forth as an individual? And I think people can relate to the idea of being a young person, wanting to have an identity beyond your family, not feeling able to have that sense of independence. And then there's a schadenfreude of going, oh, but they all have money involved. And the idea of identity gets tied in with brands. So I think there's like psychological elements we can relate to. And then there's this kind of fascinating celebrity industry element.
I think it was about this time 2 years ago that Prince Harry's autobiography came out, Spare. And of course, if the Beckhams aren't getting all the tabloid coverage, then it tends to be Prince Harry and Meghan. But it is interesting that I read that book at the time because it was the big thing of the time.
And you thought it was well written, didn't you?
Oh yeah, it was well written. I mean, it was written by the same guy who did Andre Agassi's autobiography.
That's a great book.
Yeah, right. So this was top class, absolutely top class writing, and very open about the issues, particularly how he felt targeted by the tabloid media. And I suppose I should declare I do write for the Irish edition of the Daily Mail, the Irish Daily Mail, but Prince Harry is now amongst a whole realm of celebrities who are taking a major legal action against that newspaper. For what, Dave?
Yeah, for intruding on his private life, he says, and for essentially ruining his life. He got very emotional. You saw words this week like emotional, prickly, combative, as he took to court. This is like, I think it's his third ongoing action. He's previously had some victories, and this is against the publishing group that publishes the Daily Mail in the UK and the Mail on Sunday, and he has alleged that his phones were tapped and that people were...
From age 16.
Which is crazy, if true. And, again, you say that there's a host of other celebrities like Elizabeth Hurley is another person who has said this, and it seems to be very, very emotional scenes in court in general. Harry in particular seemed to kind of get a bit misty-eyed when he brought up Meghan Markle, and again, to bring that parallel back, because just as Ro was talking, like Nicola Peltz, the American model, actress, temptress, Meghan Markle, the same thing. The parallels are crazy. But Harry has been very forthright and very outspoken in saying that his life has been completely ruined by this intrusion on the tabloids. He has said things like, you know, my friends don't leak stories. I never went to Ibiza and hung out with a reporter. I didn't make up a Facebook account to converse with reporters. I am not the one at fault here. You might, again, for the schadenfreude aspect of things, a member of the public might say, well, listen, you wrote that book and you have these shows and you had that podcast and you are a celebrity and so on. Maybe, you know, you can't run away from it now. But, you know, this recalls people like Hugh Grant taking newspapers and such to court. So this is not a new issue, but I think him at the forefront of it this week has been genuinely quite compelling.
I do not like the royals. I have kind of no interest in the monarchy. I have a huge amount of sympathy for Harry and Meghan because I think two things can be true at once. He grew up incredibly privileged and is still privileged. And I think he is deeply traumatized. He is deeply traumatized by growing up constantly in the public eye and this constant intrusion. And I absolutely believe, I mean, it's been proven that in the past, his privacy has been intruded upon by the press. I absolutely believe all of the allegations are true. That's just my opinion. But he has been followed. He has been stalked. His phones have been tapped. Like, people have been writing about his private life. People have tried to infiltrate his social circles since he was a child. And this is still ongoing. And I think what was really, really powerful to me about his testimony in court was he said, like, through this litigation, the trauma has not, it's only got worse, not better. And he said, I think it's fundamentally wrong to have put us all through this again when all we required is an apology and some accountability. The worst of it, by standing up here and taking a stand against them, they continue to come after me. This idea that in him seeking justice and in him in the past few years seeking a way of separating himself from the royals and trying to step out of that control they had over his public and private life, and that's just attracted more attention, I think that's really genuinely quite tragic.
I've just been reminded it was J.R. Moore Ringer, who is the ghostwriter or co-writer on the Prince Harry book Spare. Another listener says, Marina Hayes had a fantastic piece about this in The Guardian, about the dynamics of the celebrity industry family bringing their kids up in a world that they're probably not suited to. We've been talking a lot about the politics in Davos this week, and we're not going to go back into Donald Trump or anything, but the suggestion that Dublin could be the new Davos, that Davos literally just cannot cope with the amount of people that arrive there and that they're going to find a new location. But really, Dave, Dublin?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, like, this would be groundbreaking if it leaves at all, because it's been there since 1971. So the World Economic Forum thing. Larry Fink, who's a bit of a bigwig there, he has been talking about the possibility, I believe the Financial Times reporting this, saying that maybe we will in fact move it, take it on the road. And there was this line where he said, places like Detroit and Dublin and cities like Jakarta and Buenos Aires. Now, call me a cynic or someone who just takes things personally, but to be lumped in with Detroit...
Sorry, Detroit is
famous for
city.
For being one of the most crashed economic ghost estates of all time, and then to throw Dublin in, was he going for alliteration or was he making a wider point?
I suspect it was alliteration.
And then he brings up Jakarta and Buenos Aires, the much more sexy sounding places, no offence to Dublin, but I don't know.
I'm not sure that Buenos Aires would have the capacity to manage an event like this. I mean, I suppose famously Paddy Cosgrave brought the Web Summit out of Dublin because the Wi-Fi wasn't good enough at the RDS. I suspect the RDS is much better now, but the issue would be
really
security.
For all those private jets. Well, this idea of if Web Summit challenged our infrastructure, let's bring in, I mean, in Davos, they have 5,000 Swiss like security guards. Basically, like the infrastructure demanded from
it's
this.
It's the security
wild.
Issues. Yeah. If you had Donald Trump and the American delegation coming in, and I think there was something like 65 world leaders, and then you have all the billionaires, how would you actually provide protection in Dublin for those people? However, we are going to have the EU presidency at the end of the year, so maybe we'll get a practice run out of that.
But this would be a city shutdown, wouldn't it?
I mean, oh yeah, it would.
The EU presidency.
5,000 Swiss troops on the keys. Like, it's just Dublin.
I'm sure we could have the Irish version, Ro. They wouldn't have to be imported from Switzerland.
I don't know. I mean, if you have Trump coming over, like, it sounds like a fanciful idea. And this is a come and get me plea. That's what this is. Come on. He's shopping it around.
It's shop
window stuff. It's like a football agent talking up his man. Like this, I don't believe it for a second.
But isn't this like the Eurovision where we're like, oh yeah, that's very nice to be mentioned. We absolutely don't want to host it. Thank you very much. We can't afford it. But I think what's really ironic is that Davos has just become kind of a parody of itself. Like all of these elites and billionaires and world leaders getting together to discuss inequality, which is why I think saying Detroit and Dublin is gas. The idea that Detroit was absolutely abandoned by America and so neglected. And in Dublin, we're facing housing crisis and rising inequality. So all of these world leaders want to come around and go, isn't it terrible though, while staying in the hotels that have pushed people out of housing.
And yet finally, apparently Dublin is the number one city in the world for solo travellers, according to TripAdvisor.
Again, I found myself wondering if I was reading like fake news here, because Dublin number one, Berlin number two, then London, Santiago, Edinburgh, New York, Hanoi, Madrid, Bali and Cape Town make up the top 10. Far be it for me as a resident of Dublin for the last 12 years, whatever it is, to disagree with this, but I don't quite get it myself.
I don't get it.
But it's always like Dublin and like Stony Bar has been named the coolest, hippest neighborhood in Europe. Like this thing always happens. And I just wonder, has someone come here for 2 days, had an unbelievable time and thinks it must be like that all the time?
I live in Inchicore and we were named in the New York Times as one of the coolest neighborhoods in the world. I was delighted. So it does feel like someone doing a Google ChatGPT. But what I will say is that the survey said that Dublin feels very socially safe and friendly. And I think that's important because I think there's a lot of fear mongering in Dublin in particular right now of like crime rates are going up, which usually immediately leads into very racist anti-immigrant rhetoric and blaming like people from outside of Dublin for this. But it's the stats don't add up. There is a culture of fear mongering and there isn't actually the levels of crime to back that up. So stating that Dublin is very safe for travel and is a friendly city, I think that is a nice message to have out there.
We leave it there.
Again, I don't know what people are doing.
Ro McDermott, columnist for the Irish Times. Dave Hanratty, podcast producer for The Independent and host of the No Encores podcast. Thank you both very much for joining us.
The Last Word with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.